morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Over the weekend, there was plenty of blowback from school districts over the president's directive to let transgender students be treated consistent with their gender identity. Today, we'll talk with Hawaii DOE spokesperson Donalyn Dela Cruz. Meanwhile, pro bono attorney Lance Collins is set to argue the case against the Office of Elections before the Hawaii Supreme Court. He joins us this hour, and we'll get a response from Avalon Healthcare to the strike set to begin late today at Hawaii's largest skilled nursing facility, Halinani.
Guitarist Ian O'Sullivan's new CD is a tribute to his home, Songs from the North Shore. We'll get a live in-studio preview. I'm Chris Vanderkirk, and violinist Nancy Shubu celebrates the beauty of her surroundings in her upcoming On the Rainbow Road HPR concert.
That's the conversation for Monday, May 16th. Now the news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. And welcome back, Chris Vandercook. Nice
good morning,
to see
Beth
you.
Ann. Good to be back from dirty old New York City.
Where you obviously came back with a little bit of a cold, but we will
just a
forgive
bit.
That
just
one.
Just enough to give it some flavor. Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, we won't talk about that part.
That's right.
But we do have many things to discuss this morning, and thanks very much for making time for us in your morning. Now, if you were in Hawaii for the 2012 election, you probably remember that it didn't go smoothly. A lack of ballots in precincts, ballots showing races, a voter in a particular district wasn't entitled to cast a vote, needed ballots, going to the wrong precincts, you remember. On Wednesday, the case brought by the Green Party and seven voters will be heard by the state Supreme Court. Still at issue are the rulemaking procedures and methodologies under the Hawaii Administrative Procedure Act. Lance Collins is arguing the case pro bono, and he's in our studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth.
This is now the third run at this. Two lower courts basically said, no, everything went okay, no harm, no foul, don't need to worry about it, so why take it to the Supreme Court?
Well, actually, they did. Generally, they did say no harm, no foul, but both Judge Cahill on Maui and the ICA both agreed that horrible mistakes had been made. But what they had, both in slightly different ways and under different types of reasoning, said that, well, the result of the election wasn't affected by these series of human errors. And so, no harm, no foul, as you had said. The parties that I represent have taken this to the Hawaii Supreme Court because I think ultimately the question is does the chief elections officer have such unbridled discretion that as long as his mistakes don't affect the result of a particular race in a way that can be proven, that he should be allowed to do whatever he wants. And the argument is that, that infringes on people's right to vote. And in the case of the 2012 election, it is true that, of the people who voted and there were mishaps with the ballots, it didn't affect the outcome of any races. But we don't know how many people left from the polling. I mean, that's something that was in the record.
That's the issue, that right. There's this unknown quotient that obviously is conjecture at this point, but if people were frustrated and angry because they couldn't vote because there weren't ballots, that could have in cases of maybe some close races affected.
Right, like
affected.
Trevor Ozawa and Tommy Waters, that race was decided by 41 votes, and it happened at one of the precincts where the wrong ballots were sent and people voted on the wrong ballots or didn't have the council race. It's true that the number of people who actually voted was less than could have affected the results of the election, but the question really comes down to, well, but how many people didn't show up? And that is not to cast any question on the legitimacy of Trevor Ozawa's election. It just calls into question the chief elections officer's discretion in how to do things. And so these issues of, well, how many ballots do you create? Well, one of the issues in this case is before this election, they always printed more ballots than there were registered voters. And somebody decided in a windowless room at the Office of Elections that in 2012, they were only going to order a fraction of the number of ballots that there are of registered voters. And those kinds of decisions are something that should go out to a public hearing where people and various community groups that have some expertise or understanding of these processes all have the opportunity to present testimony and their opinion and be able to analyze the proposed rules so that it's not one person in a windowless office making this decision, and instead it's the community being able to give input to sort of guide the chief elections officer on how he exercises his authority.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what the Supreme Court does with that argument now that it's bubbled up, and we'll see if those rules, in fact, or the rulemaking procedures and processes change based on what you've been presenting all this time since the first case.
Absolutely.
Thanks very much, Lance, for coming in.
Thank you.
Lance Collins is an attorney in private practice, primarily on Maui. He's represented clients in a number of good government cases and will argue Green Party versus Nago on Wednesday in the Hawaii Supreme Court. Meanwhile, as we went into the weekend, school districts across the country heard President Obama's directive to treat transgender students the same as any other, with students allowed to choose bathrooms consistent with their gender identity. In Hawaii, there's already been pressure on the State Department of Education to create a consistent policy toward transgender students. Earlier this morning, we called DOE spokesperson Donlin Dela Cruz to see how the directive syncs with the draft policy.
We, for the last 6 months, have been working on guidelines for our transgender students. And the guidelines that we drafted were in the hands of the Attorney General's office. So when this came down, it was exciting news because now that actually gave something from the federal government where we could turn to. And so we are now taking a look at that and seeing what implications, if any, it has on our current guidelines that we've drafted. But it also provides direction from the federal government, and so we're pleased with that.
While it's not binding, there certainly is the implication that those states which don't comply might have their funding in jeopardy, as we receive roughly, about 13% of the DOE budget from the federal government. If your guidelines are in line with what the president is asking for, then there's no threat to Hawaii's education funds coming from the federal government, I would imagine.
Correct. But again, we still really need to take a look at what type of implications the ruling has on us or the policy that they've mandated. So it's really taking a look at, well, what is coming down? What do we need to do? Currently, what we have in place when it comes to bathrooms, we work on a case-by-case basis with our transgender students. We work with the students, the parents, as well as ensuring that no matter what, our transgender students feel that they have their options and that no matter what, it's a safe learning environment. So that doesn't change. So regardless of, what funding comes down, that's not the priority for us looking at what's been set by the U.S. Department of Justice. We already try to ensure a very safe environment for all of our students, not just our transgender students. So that's a big priority, first and foremost. It's not about funding.
Donlin, as you look at this as being on a case-by-case basis, though, in terms of bathrooms, are you talking about you would put in a gender-neutral bathroom in a school if there were an issue with a transgender student? Or what does it mean to handle that on a case-by-case basis if you're talking about something like a bathroom or a locker room?
So I can tell you what we do now. Again, we're going to have to take a look at the implications of what the U.S. Department of Justice has set out. But currently, for example, if a student feels uncomfortable using a certain bathroom, some of our schools have worked out to allow transgender students to use a staff bathroom. And those bathrooms are usually gender neutral. Sometimes it's not, but it depends on what's been worked out with the student and that school environment.
There's also the flip side of this, which says that if we're going to treat all students in a respectful and compassionate way, that there may be some who feel uncomfortable by sharing a bathroom or a locker room with someone who is transgendered. And that may not be terribly politically correct, but if a kid feels that way, How does the school system honor everyone if that's really the basis of what the president's directive is all about?
So, again, those are things that already we've been discussing for the past 6 months and working with various stakeholder groups, our transgender community, as well as other stakeholders within the education and within the legal system. So that comes down to civil rights for all. As we are working towards ensuring a safe environment for our transgender students or creating appropriate venues for transgender students, we need to also be very careful about students who are not transgender and ensuring that their rights are also protected. So that's something that's been within our own Attorney General's office. We've been really careful about that. Again, taking a look at what now the Department of Justice has said and seeing what implications it would have on current guidelines.
When do you expect to have the Attorney General render an opinion about the current policy that you have with him now?
Well, we were close, and then this came down Friday. So, and we're hoping that as they work on their internal review on our existing draft, and now with this guidance, how, if any, that will affect what we put together. This doesn't impact, we've already set a June Board of Education date to present where we are with our guidelines. So we're going to continue to do that, and that's in June.
All right, then we'll look forward to speaking with you then. Thanks very much for the time this morning.
I will add this. Come next school year, we will have transgender guidelines in place for our school.
Great. We'll look forward to seeing those.
Thank you.
Donlan Dela Cruz is the Director of Communications and Community Affairs Office at the Hawaii State Department of Education.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:15. Coming up, Ian O'Sullivan's Songs for the North Shore, live in our studio. But first, your quiz. This past weekend, University of Hawaii graduates were bedecked with lei in their green gowns at the 2016 Spring Commencement Ceremony. On Oahu, it was held at the University of Hawaii Stan Sheriff Center at Manoa. The UH Manoa campus was first founded in 1907 and covers 320 acres on the lower side of the lush green Manoa Valley. Since its founding, the university has taken photos of each graduating class before commencement, with the class of 1931 being the only exception. Over time, the class pictures have included both group and composite photographs, but prior to 1921, the university mandated that all class pictures would be composite photographs. The first graduating class at Manoa had only four graduates who were pictured in a composite photograph. The photos included one woman and three men. For today's backyard quiz, can you tell us in which year those original four graduates earned their degree? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know, and the first one to get it right gets the HPR T-shirt.
Good morning, I'm Sabrina from Portland, Oregon. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Musicians write about the things that touch them most deeply: home, family, loved ones. And Hawaii musicians have a special feeling for songs about home. For guitarist Ian O'Sullivan, that's Oahu's North Shore, and it's easy enough to imagine the kind of inspiration it might provide. Ian has crafted a new CD called Songs for the North Shore. He's with us this morning, guitar in hand. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning.
One of the first things that I really helped me understand Hawaii to the limited degree that I do was listening to its music when I first got here many years ago and hearing how many songs were about places more than any other place I'd been.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a really big part of Hawaiian music, you know, is that connection to place. So, yeah.
I mean, I guess the reason why that is fairly obvious, the place itself.
Right, yeah, just look out the window.
Yeah, exactly.
Provides a lot of inspiration. Yeah, so, you know, this next CD, Songs for the North Shore, I'm coming out with actually official releases this Thursday. It's 10 songs everywhere from Ka'ena Point to Kahuku Point along the North Shore.
So you could actually guide yourself, do a little guided tour, the way museums give you a set of earphones as you walk through.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's a good idea, actually.
Well, hey, it's done. It's mine.
I did. Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, we... yeah, that I grew up there, Mokulaia, sort of the North Shore's North Shore, it's kind of rural. And, you know, so there's songs for Ka'ena Point. That's such a, you know, teeming with life kind of a place. You can see whales. You can see the west side and the North Shore at the same place. And you can see Kauai in the distance and things. And I thought, you know, what a beautiful location. That needs a song. There's another song for Waialua, which is the moment you make it over the crest of the hill to the North Shore. And so you make it from the trek from town, and then you all of a sudden you make it over the hill, and you can see the sugar mill and the horizon and the agriculture reaching out.
Yeah,
and,
I know exactly the place you mean. Yeah, and there's an opening up feeling that you get, right?
Yeah, you almost feel like you can take off.
Yeah, it's kind of the start of the movie, cresting that hill.
Exactly, exactly.
But, you know, the whole thing of a sight becoming a sound.
Right.
Right? You have to... I mean, it sounds as if what you've done is you've honed in on specific details and then come up with musical equivalents to the
them. Exactly, exactly. I'm really inspired by you know, classical composers and the way that they can, you know, things like Peter and the Wolf or the French Impressionists like Ravel and things when they compose music and they're really trying to depict stories or places, you know. And I thought, well, what better fit for Hawaiian music
when you know? When you hear it done well, La Mer or Beethoven 6, you really can see program music, right?
Exactly.
You
exactly.
can really see the place and feel the place. You played me an excerpt a little while ago from a song of the Night Marchers.
Oh yeah.
And you were kind of explaining the logic of how you'd put it together. Can you just take me through that?
Yeah, so what I did basically,
I'm making you retune, which I shouldn't have done.
No, it's fine. And what I did was use reciting tones from Hawaiian chant, so something like... and I thought, you know, pulling music from slack key wasn't really the right language to depict the Night Marchers.
Yeah.
So I chose a minor key, and I use a descending chromatic line, so fret by fret... to sort of depict that march.
It's something vaguely sinister about chromaticism, yeah?
Right, and so when we put that together, we get something like... Yeah.
Yeah, definitely a haunted feeling. As you say, the slack key lick you played before... is just a little too happy to tell story.
Maybe more of a Waialua view rather than
there
the Night
go.
Marchers. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think we've got time for another sample. Do you need to retune? Or?
No, no. You know what? Why don't I just play a bit of the Night Marchers here?
Please.
So I also combine a little bit of percussion because I figured they might have drummers with them. So, yeah. And it opens up with sort of as if you were hiking, and then you realize that you're out a little bit too late, and maybe you shouldn't be there. And so that's kind of how the song starts. So this is for the Night Marchers.
Thank you.
You know, I thought that was really terrific, and there's just a lot of moods within that little segment, and very carefully applied dissonant notes. There's a very dissonant melody note.
Oh, definitely.
Where you just right at the, it's kind of on a very strong beat too.
Let's see, what do we have?
You know the one I mean, yeah.
Here.
That's it.
Yeah.
And then there's a harmony a little bit later on, the same thing, where just when you think you're going in one direction, it's not just the choice of a dissonant note is where you put it, right?
Right, exactly. That's what makes it dissonant, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's the ability to choose pitches that aren't supposed to belong,
yeah.
You know, aren't supposed to be there necessarily. But in this case, they fit perfectly.
Yeah, they really do. No, yeah. It's, the music is wonderful, and I can just imagine what some of these other tunes are like, but that's... That's a pretty good sample.
Yeah. And, you know, like Waialua, very different feeling, like we're taking off, right? Almost mm-hmm. like you can fly. And so I use ascending notes, you know, things like this. Because that gives it that rising feeling, and it's very lush, you know, mm-hmm. compared to something maybe a bit more, a little darker, a little more bluesy, right? Doesn't really
yeah.
fit. But that lush kind of sound, I think.
Very... Very major, very open air.
Yeah. So those are my impressions
and
reflections.
Amazing what you can do with
them
six little strings, Ian. Thanks so much for coming in. That's great to hear. Ian O'Sullivan's new CD is called Songs for the North Shore, and he'll be appearing at the Hale Iwa Arts Festival. And you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Going over the wall.
Just to hear the stories or the love or just life. I mean, we share just about everything on that radio station, and it gives everybody a little taste of home.
A Kentucky radio station finds a way to reach into the darkness of solitary confinement. Call home radio next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
On the street where you live, Nielsen research tells us that it's likely that 1 in 8 of your neighbors listening to Hawaii Public Radio each week. Some of them have gone beyond merely listening and, with their financial support, have made our service available for the rest of the community. Please join us in thanking these good neighbors, Leia Flores of Mililani, Linda Gu of Honolulu, and Annette Green of Hilo. You, too, can do the neighborly thing and become an HPR member donor by calling 955-8821 during business hours or by donating online at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks. With houses so expensive in Hawaii, condos are often the choice of many families to own their own homes. The mortgage may be manageable, but owners may find they're at the mercy of their homeowners association and monthly fees, especially if there's a major project that needs funding. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair took a look in today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
So, yeah, this is a story that, you know, we hear a lot. Somebody who purchased a condo, it was affordable. Who says today, well, the condo's affordable, but those association fees and how they've escalated over time, that's scary.
It is. You know, I didn't realize that there's 160,000 plus condo owners in the state of Hawaii. So Anita Hofschneider took a look at this problem. She starts her story with a condo owner in Pearl Ridge, and she gets a letter, the condo owner, from her homeowners association. Surprise, we're going to have to cover $12 million in plumbing repairs. And you're going to help us pay for it. And here's the options the condo owner gets. One, they can put $45,000 up front. That's $45,000 up front. Or they can agree to a nearly 50% increase in their monthly fees. And that monthly fee, by the way, $539. So really looking at a huge expense. And this is common in quite a lot of places. And this is the unexpected cost of owning condos. You know, you're trying not to own a house, which costs $725,000 last time I checked on Oahu. And yet owning condos is proving to not be a very cheap alternative.
Well, in some cases, the reason is simple. These condos were built in the late 60s and 70s.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, the condo owners themselves, they are not supposed to exceed their annual operating budget by more than 20%, but there's exceptions. If there's an emergency increase, like plumbing or pipes and other things like that, pipes, I guess, are plumbing, or they can get permission from a majority of the condo owners. They're also supposed to conduct studies of potential repairs and set aside reserves. There's actually a law to that effect, but it turns out a lot of them, these costs are exceeding much more than was initially expected, particularly these older buildings dating 15, 20, 30 years ago.
So, Chad, is it because this law doesn't have, you know, real teeth to it that makes the condo associations hop too?
That's right. The condos are self-regulated. If you think there's a problem, you're going to either have to sue or you're going to have to pay for mediation services. Those options are not going to be inexpensive. The Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs, it doesn't have the power to enforce these things. Instead, it's focusing on education and outreach. But if you're a condo owner, imagine if you're on a fixed income, Social Security and so forth, and suddenly your fees go up a terribly large amount, you're really in a lot of trouble. You may have to sell.
Which sounds like, given the fact that we saw the ombudsman legislation fail this past session, and what you've just said, that condo owners don't have a lot of help.
Right. And just briefly, that bill would have created a position to have someone help get involved in these situations. Florida, which has a lot of condos, has a law like that on the books. Instead, what did the legislature decide to do? Study the situation, particularly the mediation part. So we'll see if the issue comes up. It's not going away. Condos are the way to live for so many people here. And you can imagine lawmakers are hearing from their constituents.
And the situation may get worse, too. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Beth.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us daily with a reality check.
Good morning. I'm Chris Vandercook. It's 8:31, and you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio. You can talk back to us about what you hear on the show on our talkback phone line, 808-792-8217. Coming up later, violin and guitar on the Rainbow Road. But first, the news from Deutsche Welle.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Compassion and Choices, a nonprofit committed to improving care and expanding choice at the end of life. Learn more about contributing personal stories at compassionandchoiceshawaii.org.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, to err is human, right?
Well, it is, but, you know, there's some interesting ways that we can try and reduce medical errors. And today, we're going to talk about the environment. You know, how often have we seen buildings that are refurbished or transformed into doctor's offices and even, you know, St. Francis revitalized to become a senior center? But what are some of the tricks of design that can actually help reduce medical errors? So it's a real interesting question. And in fact, there's a lot of science behind it that is blows me away. I never knew about any of it.
Well, things like the shape of the space you're in, the way light comes in, that kind of thing?
Well, that and the fact that if all the rooms are designed to have stuff on the right side of the room, keeping that consistent really helps to reduce errors. You know, if you are in an operating room and all of the sutures that you use for a certain procedure are always kept in the same place, it lends itself to efficiency, but also it lends itself to reducing errors. So we're going to have an interesting discussion today because it's a different look at how you can create a space to improve patient care. We often talk about doctors doing it and making sure that they're doing everything correctly in electronic medical records, but now we're going to look at the actual physical space. What does it look like when you go to see the doctor?
Well, and actually, you know, the more you think about it, Kathy, the more sense it makes. So that would be kind of interesting to address, wouldn't it?
It is, space. And it's a lot of learning for me to realize that, you know, compared to the space when I first started practice and where I'm at now, there's a difference. It's been standardized. It's been revitalized. And just practicing in that environment made all the difference. Who knew?
Who knew? He's right. Thanks very much, Kathy. And that's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozek, tonight at 5.
Later today, more than 200 certified nurse aides at Halinane Rehabilitation and Nursing Center are scheduled to go on strike. Last week, we talked with one of them, a woman who was fired for what she says was promoting union activities to stem the workload that the CNAs say is detrimental to their patients. In short, she said there weren't enough of them, according to Unite Here Local 5. Avalon Healthcare, the owner of Halinane, the state's largest skilled nursing facility, took issue with the former employee. Steve Gold, the regional vice president for the company and the administrator of Halinane, joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Hope you are too. As we talked last week, the idea of what is the appropriate ratio came up over and over again, of the ratio of a nurse's aide to the number of patients. And some of the examples that we got were that having, you know, 3 nurse's aides or 5 nurse's aides to a floor of 50 patients was out of whack, and that compared to other places in Hawaii, that might not be the same, and that would be adding to the workload for the CNAs, particularly with things that took time with patients having to toilet, et cetera, and that it might be maybe half an hour before someone were able to get to that particular patient or the next patient. How do you calculate what the appropriate ratio is for the floors of patients that you have with the different types of patients?
Okay, well, let me start by first saying that Halinane has one of the highest, and this is a CMS, that's the Medicare Services Center, CNA staffing ratios to patients on the island. What that means is the overall number of hours that we provide to our patients is one of the highest. And that by itself can be verified at cms.gov on the internet. The second issue is that being the largest facility in Hawaii, we also have several different sized nursing stations. A typical nursing facility in the island or on the island here may have between 1 to 3 nursing stations, whereas we have 8 different nursing stations. And each station is a different size. And having different sizes means we have different numbers of beds. Each station has a different kind of patient acuity assigned to it. Some have skilled patients and some have long-term care patients. And each of those patients varies in their degree of medical need, nursing need, as well as personal care needs. Now, some of the differences that are calculated are based on whether or not somebody is working on an AM shift, which is a day shift, a PM shift, an evening shift, or a night shift. In the AM shift, you're serving 2 meals, you're getting patients up and dressing them, bathing them, and most of the activities will take place during that shift. So that has the largest staffing ratio of any part of a day. On the PM shift, you end up having staff that serve 1 meal, may bathe patients, but also are placing them to bed. So they're getting them undressed and placing them to bed. And then on the evening shift, you'll have patients that are mostly sleeping throughout the night or being assisted to go to the bathroom if they need. And that has the lowest staffing ratio. Now, these ratios, based on the time of the shift or the part of the shift, are typical kinds of ratios that are used throughout the United States and in most nursing facilities as well.
So how many patients to how many CNAs to be able to help during those various shifts?
So on a day shift, if I have one of my skilled units, we have a ratio of about 1 to 8, and that's on the Pensacola units, on the skilled units. On an evening shift, we also have a ratio of 1 to 8, that's on a skilled unit. And on a night shift, we still have 1 to 8, and that is on a skilled unit. Those are the patients with the highest acuity and having the most medical need. Now, on the long-term care units, some of the ratios vary from And let me just calculate this for you very quickly. Probably 1 to 10 on the day shift, 1 to 12 on an evening shift, and as many as could be as many as 1 to 14 to 15 on a night shift, depending upon the acuity of the resident population that we have. And those are adjusted based on the kinds of patients we have and whether or not, frankly, we get people that are calling in that have to be replaced that may be calling in sick and are not working on a shift.
Steve Gold, there was also an issue about restless patients, those that need to have someone really sitting with them, an aide who stays there with them on a one-to-one basis. Also, when someone has to be taken to the doctor, and that might remove that nurse's aide from the pool of nurse's aides. How
right.
frequently does it happen, and how many restless patients do you really have who need to have that one-to-one care?
Right. The statement that was made is that we have as many as 5 patients that need one-to-one care in this facility. That is absolutely untrue. Right now, there's only 1 patient that's on one-to-one in this building. The second part is that in order to relieve the need to pull CNAs off the shifts, we have agreed with the CNAs to ensure that we send someone else in our transport vans to doctor's appointments so that they are not removed from the floor.
I understand that over the weekend you tried to negotiate with the union and that you came up empty.
No, we came closer to an agreement, but there are just some issues that we cannot agree to. One that we offered expedited arbitration on, but we couldn't come to agreement. And frankly, there are some things that we just can't agree to that prevent us from reaching a consensus here. And then it's ultimately the right of the staff to strike. We are fully prepared to respond to all contingencies here, and our business will continue as usual.
What can you speak about what things separate you at this point?
Some of the economics are, we're still apart in some of the economics and something regarding some personnel issues which are not part of a collective bargaining agreement. And that's something that I personally don't want to get into because it is proprietary personal information regarding an individual.
So at this point, starting at 5:30 today, there'll be a strike for a few hours, but it'll really kick in for tomorrow and Wednesday.
Right, and we'll have plenty of security here and our own staff and have fully staffed the units and every unit providing the care as necessary to the population we have.
So you'll be fully staffed regardless of who is out on strike?
That's correct.
All right, we're going to leave it there for the moment. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Steve Gold is the regional vice president of Utah-based Avalon Healthcare, the company which owns Halinane Rehabilitation and Nursing Center. Mr. Gold is also the administrator of the facility and has 40 years of experience in post-acute care and is a licensed nursing home administrator in several western states. Certified nurses' aides are set to start a 3-day strike late today.
Earlier in the backyard quiz, we asked when UH Manoa graduated its first class. The class of 2016 consisted of over 1,000 students in the undergraduate program alone. That's a substantial increase from the 4 students who made up the first class. Of these 4 graduates, 3 contributed their self-portraits to the class picture. The names of the 3 graduates were Leslie C. Clark, Yong Fuk Tong, and Louise Gulick. For those of you enrolled in the upcoming fall 2016 semester, don't stop by the Hamilton Library Archives collection, where you'll see a wide variety of photographs of the past graduating classes. Or if you prefer to look at the collection at home, you can see the Hamilton Library's Archives and Manuscripts Department website. There you can see, among others, the class photo from the UH Manoa class of 1912, which is the answer we were looking for.
And Alavi Rumi knew that answer and called in, and will be receiving the T-shirt. Now at 8:45, that's the answer to today's quiz. If you've got a backyard quiz for us, you know you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and you just might hear it on a future show. This is how it feels. As we go.
Aloha, I'm Jordan Segundo. You're tuned in to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our very small planet. And as usual, to get the details on that and things to look for in our dark island skies, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's happening?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn in our evening sky. All three planets are incredibly bright and will be gracing our skies as we pass into midsummer. Now, the moon this week is going to be full, which of course means stargazing in the islands is going to be a little tricky, although it will make for beautiful moonlit walks along the beach.
And now we have an exciting trip back to the Mauna Kea summit. Apparently, Christopher has news about an observatory there catching a remarkable image for us.
Yes, astronomers at the Subaru Observatory atop Mauna Kea have taken the opportunity to capture some incredible images of a comet known catchily as 67P. This comet is making its way into the outer reaches of the solar system, and the astronomers at Subaru have wasted no time in tracking it down.
Now, is this one we've seen before? These names are hard to keep track of, but it sounds vaguely familiar.
It should sound familiar. In fact, Subaru has imaged 67P before, when the comet was traveling between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. This time, though, they were able to capture the comet in amazing detail using the extremely powerful and versatile Hyper Subprime Cam.
Now, is this a regular camera, or what kind of device is this?
Well, this incredible instrument can image everything from galaxies, stars, and nebulae through to planets, asteroids, and comets. Our listeners can see this stunning image of Comet 67P on the Stargazer website.
And SubprimeCam doesn't just do the images, it also provides a lot of other information, right?
Indeed. SubprimeCam's data can be used to help us tell everything from the age of an object right through to what it is made of. It is truly a magnificent instrument. Right now, the Hyper SubprimeCam is one of the premier instruments in use on Mauna Kea. You can think of Hyper SubprimeCam as a high-tech, supercharged digital camera, although this one wouldn't fit in your phone or your laptop. The camera is so big, it is taller than a human being, and it weighs in at around 3 tons.
No selfie stick for that thing, huh?
Definitely not.
Christopher Phillips and another exciting report here on Stargazer. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
When Nancy Shupu, violinist, came to Hawaii, she found her wellspring of inspiration, one that has brought her to the recording of her second solo CD, Rainbow Road. She's getting ready to perform it in our Atherton studio this weekend, and she joins us this morning. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning, Chris.
You were telling me that although these are songs about Hawaii in some ways, that they're not specifically songs of place, maybe in the way that Ian's stuff we were talking about earlier was.
Not necessarily. It's true that I do get a lot of my inspiration just from the natural beauty mm-hmm. that's all around us here in Hawaii. I mean, who couldn't, you know?
Yeah.
But a lot of my inspiration actually comes more from within myself, because I just, you know, it's that connection that I have with, I don't know, maybe the life force, whatever you want to call it, divine spirit. That is what really inspires me. And I feel like with my music, what I really want to do is bring a little bit of heaven to earth for people. I want to, that when they listen to my songs, I want them to be just so transported away from their normal everyday life and all this stuff, you know, that's going on, that they'll just be in some other place where they can remember, you know, what's really important in their life, you know, why they're here, and just reconnect with that something that is special to them.
It sounds as if at some point in your life, music did that to you.
Music's always done that for me. Yes.
I mean, it has to, something has to put that in, right, for you to be able to release it.
Yes, it's always been my connection. And, I was very passionate about wanting to become a violinist from the time I was in high school, actually. It was when I decided I wanted to become a violinist. But my mom, she was dead set against this idea.
Uh-huh.
And I really, really had to fight for it. She didn't want me to go into the city and get lessons with a teacher. I knew I needed a really, you know, good teacher that mm-hmm. could help me prepare for conservatory auditions. And she was not going to let me go. And I had to wait till I was 16 and I could drive. And I put an ad in the newspaper to clean houses. And that for when I got the first call to clean a house, my mom, she came in the door that night after work, and she hadn't even taken off her coat yet. And I said, "Mom, I said, I've got my driver's license. I've got a job. I can, you know, pay for my own lessons. I said, all I need you to do is sign this form."
Yeah.
And she did. She finally relented, and she signed the form, and I was able to go and get the lessons.
You can understand that kind of parental concern that
definitely.
Can be a path to heartbreak, right?
Yes, it was done with the best of intentions.
Sure.
She was trying to be a good parent because it's just so difficult to make it in the world of professional classical music.
And success is confined to those who have a very deep well of passion, of artistry.
Exactly.
To draw upon.
Exactly.
Right?
And that's kind of what I needed to. It's really good for me because I had to really fight for what I wanted.
Yeah.
And if I had not had to do that, that was what helped me. It helped me to build up the strength to have the endurance to make it for the long haul. I mean, hours of practicing every day.
You found out later on that strength was essential to
exactly.
the path you took.
Exactly. I needed it, so it was perfect.
Yeah.
You know, my mom was doing her job in exactly the way she was supposed to be doing it.
So kids out there, if your parents are giving you a hard time either to practice or to not practice, they're doing it often for a pretty good reason.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Nancy, let's leave time for a little sample of we have a recording, a backup track of one of your tunes. Which tune is this?
This is Rainbow Road. It's the
title
track
title tune,
of my new, I should say, Hoku-nominated CD.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Terrific. Well, let's... Lovely, Nancy. Thank you. In the accompaniment left, you know, which is mostly arpeggios, long tones, it left a lot of room for the violin to come through, I felt.
Yeah.
That's really, really fitting.
Yeah, and Ian is the guitarist on the CD.
Yeah.
And if I may say, I had just a wonderful group of musicians I played with.
Sure.
Derek Nakamoto was on piano and arranged and produced, and Dean Taba on double bass.
Makes a big difference, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. My gosh. It's like having the dream team.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because with a melody like that, and it's a lovely melody, but it has to, you can't have it crowded by the other instruments, right?
Right. Yeah, so that's why it's so important, the arrangement. I have to say, I didn't even start composing until just a few years ago. And the main reason why was because, being a violinist, I've always been dealing just with melody.
Yeah.
And I was not very comfortable on the piano, which is the only other instrument I played that had harmony. So it was really when I got more comfortable with harmony and playing the piano that enabled me to really expand and be able to do this.
Well, it's you have an exciting future ahead with this. Thanks so much for coming in, Nancy.
Thank you, Chris.
Violinist and singer-songwriter Nancy Shoup Wu is a graduate of the Yale School of Music, performed songs from a new CD, Rainbow Road, in HPR's Atherton studio Saturday, May 21st. She'll be joined by guitarist Zanuck Kapala-Lindsay and pianist Aaron Nelson.
Another call to probe Exxon's alleged climate fraud.
The CEO of Exxon may say nice things at a Davos cocktail party about climate change being real and Exxon being interested in a carbon price, but down at the American Petroleum Institute where they lobby, they're telling people, don't believe that. You cross us and you're toast.
I'm Steve Curwood, and that's Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
This afternoon at 4, following Fresh Air.
Beth Ann, of all the bizarre discussions that we can expect to go on during the upcoming election year, this who gets to use the John has particularly baffled me.
And you've been hearing a lot of it, as a lot of us have been hearing it.
It just exploded in the last couple of weeks, especially.
Although, you know, to be fair, in Hawaii, there's been a pressure to create a policy toward transgendered students for quite a while.
Yeah.
And we saw a few events in this last month, too. And we'll be following that and see what happens once the Attorney General's office finishes looking at the draft policy from Hawaii's DOE. In the meantime, we got to say goodbye because it's almost 9 o'clock, but we'll be back tomorrow. And the Peace Corps has been going strong now for 55 years, albeit with some controversies in recent years. We'll talk with Carrie Hessler-Radlett, the Peace Corps National Director, tomorrow morning.
And we'll meet Hawaii's new National Shakespeare Competition champ, Harry Dalbert.
If you want to be in touch, you can call our talkback line at 808-792-8217, or you can send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of the show or want to pass one, you can find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about the show. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of the Conversation.